You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. Today, Reggie discusses the narrow world of ego. He says that we typically perceive the world beyond ego as shadows and darkness. But when we enter the unknown depths of the body through the practice of meditation, we tap into the boundlessness of the universe. This talk was given at the 2007 Meditating with the Body retreat, held at the Blazing Mountain Retreat Center in Crestone, Colorado.
So I think we should talk about the unknown. Each one of us has a very restricted domain of awareness, which we identify as our familiar world. And largely, this restricted domain is determined by our culture. We have this very restricted domain of the familiar, and this is surrounded by a perimeter of shadow. Shadow. And beyond that is darkness. And for our culture, we deny the existence of anything outside of our restricted domain. We do not acknowledge that there is anything outside of what we can see and prove and bring into the arena of our control. But most other cultures will tell you that the domain in the shadows and in the darkness is actually the domain of reality. And that the process of becoming a human being is to make a relationship with the shadows and the darkness. The drum has been used forever, and is also used in the Vajrayana tradition, the Buddhism that, of this lineage, as a way of calling the unknown into our lives. We have, in modern culture, there is a tremendous paranoia of the unknown. And frankly, the unknown comes through to us in many ways. It comes through to us in anything that's different from us, even in points of view that are different or people that are different. All the realms of being that are different, trees are different from us. They can be vehicles of the unknown. Nature, in world religions, and particularly the Aboriginal traditions, we talk about the unseen world, the other world. The other world is the world that lies in the shadows, but somehow it's the underlying foundation of everything. So this comes up in working with the body because, strangely enough, the body is the unknown. We have a version of the body that, I think I have my body. I have this very clear scientific picture. We know all these things about the body. And I have my attitudes toward my body. My body has a certain envelope. We have all kinds of beliefs. And that belief system has very little relationship to the actual experience of the body. The body itself actually is the unknown. When we begin to explore it, we begin to realize we're running into something that we actually don't know, and something that is constantly, you could say, communicating with us. And communicating with us in a very simple, practical way. I'm tense here. I feel anxiety there. I have this achiness over there. I feel a lot of openness in this other place. And it's not as if the body is a solid reality. It isn't. It's an ever-changing manifestation. It's an ever-changing communication. It's like in a relationship that we might have with someone that is actually very open and free-flowing. You may have hung around that person for a long time, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, but in your interactions, you never know what's going to happen, and it's always fresh. It never repeats itself ever. Not if you're actually paying attention to your experience of this other person. It's very fresh. At that point, the relationship becomes a gateway to the unknown. Now you could say, well, who cares about the unknown? I don't care about the unknown. I don't like the unknown. I want to just hang out in my little fenced-in yard of consciousness. I have my little lawn, and I have my picket fence, and I have my little electric lawnmower. And, you know, if the grass gets like an inch, you know, too high, I just go out and mow it down. And if dandelions come in, I just rip them out. And if, you know, any mole comes in under the fence, we get these mole traps. Do you know what they are? You know, these... My father used to have these. My father was actually a very gentle person, and I was horrified that he had no problem going out and putting mole traps in their yard. There are these... For those of you who don't know, they're, at least in the old days, they have these iron things you put down over the mole thing, and it has these... It's like a portcullis, these, you know, three or four iron sharpened rods, and when the mole goes through, bam, right into his body and kills him. And the thing is, you know, you don't pull the mole up and apologize and bury it, you just leave the mole on the ground. You just pull your thing up and wipe the blood off and go put it somewhere else. So this is our approach to our little fenced-in yard of my personal me, my precious ego. And if anybody comes up to the fence, they're welcome to come up to it, but don't you dare come in. Or, you know, some of us have, we speak softly, and others have AK, whatever those things are. What do you call those guns? AK-47. And we will blast you if you come in my territory. Now, you could say, well, what's the problem? You know, I'm happy with my little restricted ego. I don't have a problem with that. And, you know, fuck anybody else that tries to tamper with it. We're going to just keep the grass short and nothing else is allowed in. But there is a problem, which, as you know, which is that that's not what human life is about. In a sense, not even... We're not just talking about somebody else's idea of human life. We're talking about that in our human biology, in our genetic system, living in that little fenced-in yard, that's not who we are as people, and that's not who we've ever been. It's become a way of life in the modern world, granted, because of the way the world is and because of the patterns in education and child-rearing, everything, you know, we can talk about. But it's incredibly unsatisfying to live that way, even though a lot of people do, and their whole life is built on just simply protecting the integrity of that little fenced-in yard. But it's not really us as human beings. Anthropology tells us this. We know this. And we know this ourselves. We know this from world religions. We know it from the Aboriginal traditions. And we know it in our own life, that way of simply trying to live the tiniest possible existence so that we can protect it and we don't have to change, that's really inconsistent with our biology. As human beings, in our genes, change and transformation is a demand. It's a biological demand. So The alternative to that approach is to begin to make a relationship with what is outside of our little fenced-in yard, and to begin to make our yard bigger. And the only way to make our yard bigger is actually to allow ourselves to be invited out, to be called out. And the world does call us out. It calls us out in various ways. And, you know, there are a lot of crazy things that go on in people's lives that, from a conventional viewpoint, are regarded as very bad. People who drink too much, people who maybe they drink too much because they can't stand that yard and they're trying to break out. People who take drugs. People who go to India and live and get deathly ill. People who quit their jobs. People who walk out of their marriages or just engage in all kinds of disruptive behavior. People who are oppositional in their relationships. I mean, these are all, in a sense, maybe they're not really going anywhere in the long run, but they are expressions of the human longing to break free of the tiny little restricted yard of ego. But there's a more creative way for us to make a relationship with the outside, with the larger world, because really, the unknown, it's just the larger world. But it's the larger world that we have blocked out and repressed. Where have we repressed that larger world? This is the kind of the key point. Our body has no ability to wall off reality. We talk about people having boundaries, but the body itself actually has no boundaries. The body itself is actually open to the entire universe. It senses, it feels, and it receives, not only in our immediate environment, like those of us sitting in this room. It feels everything that is outside. It feels the weather. It feels the seasons. It feels the sun and the moon and the movement of the planets and the stars. It feels the suffering of people all over this planet. It feels the suffering of the animals. It feels the everything that's going on in the environment. It senses the unknown world in a very powerful way. The people who have died, it senses them because they haven't disappeared. They're just not embodied. They're all here. There are crowds and flocks and hordes of spirits who have passed beyond who are in this very room now with us, but we don't see them. Maybe we sense them. So the body itself actually is the receiver. It is the completely open and unobstructed knower of this vast, beautiful world that we live in. And the only thing that happens is, as I mentioned yesterday, is we actually block off the knowledge of the body in order to maintain this little tiny postage stamp of a yard known as ego. That we, you know, we make our world so small that we actually can control it. But we only do so by walling ourselves off from the knowledge that is actually already in us. It's in the body, completely and fully. The tanka here, this is a Tibetan tanka, which is traditionally hung over a shrine in this tradition. And you'll notice this is a female figure, a female Buddha named White Tara. And she represents the fundamental awakened quality of the human person, which is us, whether we're male or female. She shows us that the fundamental quality has the openness, the sensitivity, the profundity, and the love of the feminine presence, all of us, even if we're macho, tough guys. This is our basic nature. And you'll notice a very interesting thing about her iconography. She has seven eyes. She has the two human eyes, but she has a third eye right in the middle, indicating that she sees things actually outside the little fenced-in yard of ego. She knows the whole of reality fully. And the other interesting thing is she has eyes on her hands. Means that the hands know. The hands are knowing. They have knowledge. They actually are an organ of sight. And she has eyes on her soles of her feet, which means the soles of our feet are knowing. They know reality. The two human eyes only see the conventional world, but the other five eyes actually see the totality of reality. And those eyes, four of them are in the body. The body knows. The body is in touch with everything. And in the modern world, the reason we have disconnected, again, as I said yesterday, is because we don't want the information. We have been taught, and we have a culture that survives on not knowing. I mean, the modern, the modern corporate culture could not survive if people were in touch with their bodies and they sensed what that corporate way of being does to human beings, people who work for, within the corporate society, to the societies and peoples of the world who are exploited because of corporate culture, the animals that are tormented and tortured and slaughtered for profit, the degradation, the cutting down of forests everywhere in the world, and particularly in Asia, these old teakwood forests just being turned into dust bowls, pollution of the ocean. You know, if people were in touch with their bodies, the unbelievable exploitation of humans and animals and the world couldn't occur. It couldn't, because no one could bear, no one could bear to do that. So what do? We deny. We disconnect. And we live in that little little yard. And we not only live in the little yard, we put a bubble over it of opaque black plastic. So we actually pretend that there's nothing out there. We live in this little, maybe 8x8 yard. And meantime, there's this limitless, infinite universe beyond. And we pretend that it doesn't exist. And it is pretending, because we know, from our own experience and the experience of our friends and acquaintances, that there's a huge amount of knowledge, actually, that comes in all the time to all of us, that there's a world out there, actually. It's not that easy. We don't really, the universe is not the size of a postage stamp. And we actually know that, but we pretend that it is. We pretend that there's nothing out there. There's no life. There are no other people. There aren't even family members. We don't even actually live with actual people in our families. It's all dead. It doesn't mean anything. There's nothing out there. But it's pretending, because actually we know better. So when we begin to work with the body, what we're really doing is we're tapping into knowledge that already exists in us of this huge, endless universe that we live in, and all of the beings and all of the experiences and all of the living and all of the dead. This is what we're doing when we work with the body. We're starting to open the pathways, open the gates to this limitless being, that we're involved in. So when we, the purpose of this retreat really is to give you an understanding of the picture, the full picture, which is what I did yesterday a little bit and I'm doing today. And a lot of it, this this view is very important for everybody here. It's important that you understand what's at stake and how much is available to you through the work. I mean, everything's available. Because for different people here, the journey is going to unfold in different ways. And you're going to discover different areas of this endless universe through your work. And it's important that you have a way to hold it in your own mind. Otherwise, it'll seem too freaky, or things are going to come up that are very important, but you won't trust them because you'll be thinking in the old way. But we actually need to think in the new way, which is the really old way, of course. I mean, what we're talking about here is something that is not nothing new here. This has been going on for a long time before the modern thing. So that's one purpose of this retreat, is for me to give you the largest possible point of view on the work, so that we're not going to limit you and your journey. One of the kind of difficulties with modern culture, and even the really creative parts of modern culture, I mean, let's take modern psychology. Psychology often has a particular model of human development and human behavior. And this model of one school or another school may be a bigger model than the one you live in, and therefore engaging in study of psychology and working therapeutically can be actually very helpful in giving you a little bit bigger space to live in. But the fact of the matter is, there is no model that can ever be created that's actually going to be big enough for you or for me. Because our life is ahead of what anyone thinks. And we live now, and the discoveries that each one of us makes on our journey have never happened before. The particular individual discoveries that we are making, they're not in any books, they're not in any texts, they're not written down anywhere, and they're not even in anybody's mind. When, we haven't really talked about very much about the structure of spiritual traditions, but in the agricultural religions, you have people who are supposed to be experts, the priests, the swamis, the rinpoches. You know, these are people who are set up, and they're usually men, by the way, which I think is interesting. They're set up as if they have answers, and then you go study with them, and you learn the answers, and then you're supposed to apply them to yourself. That's not good enough, because anybody's answers are answers that they've come to, or answers that tradition has come to. And that's old news. And the thing about each human life is, it's new news. Each human life is new news. If you look back at the aboriginal communities, these communities of 25 or 30 people that seem to be genetically determined, that existed up until the time of agriculture. This was the size of the human community. Every single person in that community is considered to be coming from the other world with information that is brand new and is needed in order for the community to live. We have, in our genetic system, we have a need to deliver that kind of fresh and unprecedented and unique message to our world. Each one of us comes, and it's a biological imperative. This is not a matter of choice. Part of being a fulfilled human being is we must come and we must deliver our individuality and our uniqueness to our world. And we live in a culture where that is not only is it not invited, it's actually not allowed. One of the things that really struck me when my two daughters were teenagers was that it was the kids who completely couldn't manage that were the interesting kids, and the kids who actually saw what was going on. And a lot of them wound up in jail or on drugs or runaways living in, in New York City, somewhere on the street. These these were the kids that actually got it. And I met a lot of them because my daughters, even though they didn't go there, those were the kids they hung around. And initially I was, well, why don't you hang around with these kids that wear these little Oxford shirts and the sweaters who get good grades? I mean, seriously, I hate this, embarrassing, but this was my initial. But then I started to meet some of these other kids and I said, you know what? These kids are a lot more interesting than those other kids. In fact, these, and then you talk to them and you realize they know exactly what's going on. It's unbelievable. So, you know, it's in us. And in, you know, our work with the body, we are beginning to uncover something that's a lot bigger than what we have been given in modern culture, and a lot bigger than what modern culture even is willing to accept or hear. And it's very important for us to be really be savvy and really understand this journey. The thing is, you might think that this will make you a non-functional person in modern society, but that's actually not true, because the more we understand the very, very deep human need to discover and be an individual and to deliver the unique creativity of our human birth to our world, and the more we begin to grow into that and begin to feel it and find it in ourselves, the more we will understand the pain and the suffering of everybody who can't do that. And we see, you know, we look at people, when we look at people with these two human eyes, we don't see that much. But when we look with this eye and with the eyes on the hands and the eyes on the feet, everybody we meet, the more you deepen your own sense of who you really are, the more you see how tormented they are and how lost and how confused. And all of the bravado and all of the, you know, ability to magnetize other people is just a cover for very deep human sadness and a sense of despair that most modern people feel. And it makes you able to move through the world with a tremendous amount of openness and skill and genuine love for people. Not a kind of phony compassion where you give a homeless person, you know, a quarter, but where you actually love the people that you meet, and you see their suffering, and you see how much they need to be who they are. They need to find themselves, even if they themselves can't admit it. So it doesn't make you non-functional at all. It makes you very tender. And it is true, you know, my wife and I were talking about this last night. It means that you feel their pain. And that's something maybe that we don't particularly want to do. We don't want to feel how freaked out and tormented and confused somebody else is. But, you know, part of, there's a price to pay for becoming who we are. And part of the price is we have to feel the suffering of other people. That's part of the deal. We can't just become who we are and disregard this world that we live in and all of its pain and all of its sorrow. That's not the deal. The deal is we have to actually live in this world in a fully embodied way, and we have to hold the suffering of this world in our hearts. But of course, being able to do that is hugely joyful. Strangely enough, in the midst of our greatest sorrow for another, there's a huge amount of joy that we can actually do that. We can actually feel the suffering of other people. We can open our hearts. We can open our being to this world. And of course, now the pain that we feel is not just the pain of the people. It's the pain of everything, of this whole creation that we're part of. So, working with the body, we are entering into a truly endless journey of discovery and becoming. And It is the, in a sense, the most challenging thing anyone could ever do. That's true. At the same time, all the way along, there is fulfillment and joy and a feeling of truly coming into one's life. So I want to just encourage you, you know, as we do this work together, of course, when that little picket fence starts shaking and wobbling, there's going to be a certain amount of apprehension. But don't worry. It's apprehension that is temporary. And when those, you begin to realize that the picket fence bottom part is rotting, makes you nervous. Oh, this is, what's going on here? It's like you wobble the picket fence. You know, sometimes I actually had a fence like that, where we didn't creosote the bottom or whatever they do. And after a couple of years, I went over and wobbled it, and it just came off in my hand. This seemingly secure fortress actually begins to dissolve, begins to fall apart. And there's going to be a certain amount of apprehension, anxiety. But the thing is, it's the anxiety and the fear you might feel before meeting the person that you're going to spend the rest of your life with, who is going to open your world and open your heart. Anytime we're on the verge of real growth, you know, of meeting something that is ourselves but in a much bigger way, there's always going to be a sense of fear. Always. So be afraid. But don't be afraid of being afraid. Be willing to be afraid. Be afraid. Fear is fabulous. It's wonderful. It's a sign of opening the heart.
More of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.